and the sea smoothed behind it. In the morning, Mac couldn't sit up. Louis caught an albatross, wrenched its head off, and handed it to Phil, who let the blood flow into Mac's mouth. They ate the bird eagerly, Louis and Phil dipping the meat in the ocean to give it flavor. They fed bites to Mac, but it didn't revive him. On the evening of the 33rd day, Mac turned his face to Louis. "Am I going to die?" Louis looked at Mac. He didn't want to lie to him, in case he had something he needed to say or do before life left him. Louis said he thought he'd die that night. Mac had no reaction. Phil and Louis lay down, put their arms around Mac, and fell asleep. Sometime that night, Louis was lifted from sleep by a breathy sound, a deep outrushing of air, slow and final. He knew what it was. Francis McNamara had begun his last journey with a panicked, disastrous act, consuming the only food they had. But in his last days, in the struggle against the deflating raft and jumping sharks, he'd given all he had left. It probably hastened his death, but it may have saved Phil and Louis. At the end of his brief life, Mac had redeemed himself. In the morning, Phil and Louis knelt over the body. Louis wanted to give him a religious eulogy but didn't know how, so he recited passages from movies, and he prayed for himself and Phil. If God would save them, he vowed, he'd serve heaven forever. Louis cradled Mac's body. It felt as if it weighed no more than 40 pounds. He slid Mac gently into the water. Mac sank away. The sharks let him be. The next night, Louis and Phil completed their 34th day on the raft. Though they didn't know it, they'd passed what was almost certainly the record for survival adrift on an inflated raft. If anyone had survived longer, they hadn't lived to tell about it. The raft bobbed west. Storms came now and then, replenishing the water. Louis made a hook out of his lieutenant's pin and caught one fish before the pin broke. Phil and Louis could see the bend of their thigh bones under their skin, their bellies hollow, their ribs stark. Their skin glowed yellow from raft dye. Their hunger dimmed, an ominous sign. They'd reached the last stage of starvation. One morning, they woke to a strange stillness. The raft sat motionless. The ocean stretched out glossy smooth, reflecting the sky in crystalline perfection. They had found the doldrums. The eerie pause of wind and water that lingers around the equator. Phil watched the sky, whispering that it looked like the surface of a pearl. The water looked so solid, it seemed they could walk upon it. When a fish broke the surface far away, the sound carried to them with absolute clarity. Pristine ringlets of water circled outward around the place where the fish had passed, then faded. They fell into reverent silence. Their suffering was suspended. They weren't hungry or thirsty. Such extraordinary beauty, Louis thought, was too perfect to have come by chance. That day was to him a gift, crafted deliberately, compassionately, for him and Phil. Joyful and grateful as they were dying, Louis and Phil bathed in that day until sunset brought it to an end. On the 40th day, Louis was lying beside Phil under the remains of Phil's ruined raft, which Louis had made into a canopy. Suddenly he sat up. He heard singing. He nudged Phil and asked if he heard anything. Phil said, "No." Louis slid the canopy off and squinted into the daylight. Above him, floating in a bright cloud, he saw the silhouettes of 21 human figures. They were singing the sweetest song he'd ever heard. Louis stared up, awestruck. What he was seeing was impossible, yet he felt absolutely lucid. This was, he felt certain, no hallucination. He sat under the singers, memorizing the melody, until they disappeared. Phil had heard and seen nothing. Whatever this was, it belonged to Louis alone. A week passed with no food and no rain. The raft was a gooey mess, its patches bubbling outward, about to pop. It wouldn't bear the men much longer. Phil noticed that there were more birds. Then they began to hear planes. Sometimes they'd see a tiny speck in the sky, always much too distant to be signaled, and surely Japanese. As days passed, more planes appeared. On the morning of the 46th day, no sunrise came. There was only a gloomy illumination of an ominous sky. Phil and Louis looked up apprehensively. The wind caught them sharply. The sea churned and arched its back, sending the raft up to dizzying heights. To the west, something appeared, so distant it could only be glimpsed from the tops of the swells. The moment the sea tossed them up and their eyes grasped it, Phil and Louis knew what it was. It was an island. Chapter 17. Typhoon. All day, under a gyrating sky, Louis and Phil rode the swells, feeling a weary thrill as the island peeked into view. Slowly it became distinct. They saw a bright white line where waves dashed against a beach or reef. That afternoon, one island became two, then many. Overhead, a colossal storm was gathering. The men rowed landward. The sky broke. A slashing rain came down and the islands vanished. The ocean began heaving and thrashing. The wind sent the raft spinning up swells perhaps 40 feet, then careening down into troughs as deep as canyons. Phil and Louis were in a typhoon. Wave after wave slammed into the raft, tipping it sideways and peeling it upward. To stop it from flipping, Louis and Phil bailed in water to weigh it down, sat on opposite sides to balance their weight, and lay down to keep the center of gravity low. They held on. Night fell and the storm pounded. The raft raced over hundreds of mountains of water. At times the men felt themselves flying in the darkness as the raft was swept in the air. Louis felt even more intensely afraid than he'd felt as Green Hornet was falling. They thought of the land they could no longer see, fearing that any second they'd be flung into a reef. Sometime in the night, the storm died away. In its wake came the sweetest scent. Soil, greenness, rain washing over living things. The scent of land. As dawn neared, the men heard the hiss of water scouring a reef. Exhausted, they took turns napping, with one man on the lookout for land. Somewhere along the way, they both fell asleep. They woke in a new universe. After weeks in open ocean, they were surrounded by islands. On one, they saw a deserted native village. They'd heard of the Japanese capturing and shipping out natives as slaves and wondered if that had happened here. They began rowing for shore. Louis had predicted they'd find land on the 47th day. Phil had chosen the 46th. Because they'd spotted land on the 46th and were reaching it on the 47th, they decided they'd both been right. Louis gazed at a tiny island with one tree on it. a strange thing happened. The tree became two trees. After a moment's confusion, he suddenly understood. It wasn't an island, and those weren't trees. It was a boat. It had been perpendicular to them, leaving only one mast visible, and then it turned, bringing the rearward mast into view. Louis and Phil ducked and rowed as fast as they could, trying to get ashore before they were spotted. They were too late. The boat sped toward them. Louis and Phil rowed hard, but the boat caught them and drew alongside the raft. Along the deck stood a line of Japanese men, aiming guns at Louis and Phil. A sailor threw a rope, and Louis caught it. He and Phil tried to climb up to the boat, but their legs were too weak. The sailors tied them to a rope ladder and dragged them up. On the deck, Louis and Phil tried to rise, but their legs buckled. With the sailors herding them, they crawled to the mast. The sailors lashed them to it and bound their hands behind them. A sailor spoke to them in Japanese, apparently asking questions. Another waved a bayonet past Louis's face, trying to hack off his beard. One cracked a pistol into Phil's jaw, then moved to do the same to Louis. Louis tipped his head forward, then when the sailor swung, jerked his head back. He made the man miss, but smacked his head against the mast. The captain approached and chastised the crewmen. The mood changed. Louis and Phil's hands were untied, and they were given water and two biscuits. Louis ate slowly, savoring each crumb. It was his first food in 8 days. Louis and Phil were transferred to a second boat, where a crewman fed them more biscuits and some coconut. A man approached, Japanese-English dictionary in hand, and asked questions. Phil and Louis told of their journey. The boat drew up to an island. Louis and Phil were blindfolded, and men half carried them off the boat. After a few minutes, Louis felt himself being laid down on something soft. His blindfold was removed. He and Phil were in an infirmary, lying on beds. Through a window, he saw Japanese soldiers thrusting bayonets into dummies. An officer spoke to the Japanese surrounding the castaways, then spoke in English, apparently repeating himself so Louis and Phil would understand. "These are American flyers," he said. "Treat them gently." A doctor came in, smiled, examined Phil and Louis, and smoothed ointment on their salt sores. Louis and Phil took turns standing on a scale, each with a man ready to catch him if his legs failed. Phil, who'd weighed about 150 pounds when he'd stepped aboard Green Hornet, now weighed about 80 pounds. By different accounts, 5-foot-10-inch Louis, who'd weighed about 160 before the crash, weighed 67 pounds, 79.5 pounds, or 87 pounds. The doctor had cognac, eggs, ham, milk, fresh bread, and fruit salad brought in. Louis and Phil feasted. When they were done, they were seated before Japanese officers who gaped at the shrunken yellow men. An officer asked how they'd ended up there. Louis told the story as the officers listened, fascinated. Louis and Phil knew where their journey had begun, but didn't know where it had ended. The officers told them. They were in the Marshall Islands. They drifted 2,000 miles. Two beds were made up, and the castaways were invited to rest. Slipping between cool, clean sheets, their stomachs full, their sores soothed, they were deeply grateful. Phil had a relieved thought. They are our friends. Louis and Phil stayed in the infirmary for 2 days, attended by kind Japanese. On the third day, an officer came, bearing beef, chocolate, coconuts, and news. They were being taken to another atoll. The name he gave sent a tremor through Louis. Kwajalein. It was the place known as Execution Island. After you leave here, the officer said, we cannot guarantee your life. Aboard the freighter, Louis and Phil were treated well. But as they drew up to Kwajalein, the Japanese suddenly became harsh. On came the blindfolds, and Louis and Phil were carried ashore and dumped on a hard surface. When Louis said something to Phil, a boot kicked him as a voice shouted, no! An engine started, and they were moving. They were on a truck. In a few minutes, the truck stopped, and Louis was tugged out and carried again. There was walking, a darkening, and the feeling of being thrown backward. Louis's back struck a wall, and he fell to a floor. Someone yanked off his blindfold. A door slammed, a lock turned. At first, Louis could barely see. His eyes darted about uncontrollably. His mind raced, flitting wildly from thought to thought. After weeks of endless openness, he was disoriented by the compression of space around him. Slowly his thoughts quieted and his eyes settled. He was in a cell, about the length of his body and little wider than his shoulders. There was a small window in the door. The floor was strewn with gravel, dirt, and maggots, and the room hummed with flies and mosquitoes already swarming on him. There was a hole in the floor with a latrine bucket below it. The air hung scorching, hot, and still, heavy with the stench of human waste. Louis looked up. In the dimness, he saw words carved in the wall. 9 Marines marooned on Macon Island, August 12, 1942. Below were 9 names. In August 1942, after an American raid on a Japanese base at Macon in the Marshall Islands, 9 Marines had been mistakenly left behind. Captured by the Japanese, they'd disappeared. Louis was almost certainly the first American to learn they'd been taken to Kwajalein. But they weren't here now. Louis felt a wave of foreboding. He called to Phil. Phil's voice answered, distant and small. He was down the hall in a squalid hole just like Louis's. Each asked the other if he was okay. They knew it was likely the last time they'd talk, but if they wished to say goodbye, neither had the chance. There was shuffling in the corridor as a guard took up his station. Louis and Phil went quiet. Louis looked down at his body. Legs that had sprung through a 4-minute, 12-second mile on that last Hawaiian morning were now useless. His vibrant body had shrunken until only the bones remained, draped in yellow skin, crawling with parasites. All I see, he thought, is a dead body breathing. He dissolved into hard, racking weeping. He muffled his sobs, so the guard wouldn't hear him. Part 4. Chapter 18. A Dead Body Breathing. A biscuit was tossed into Louis's cell, breaking into bits on the floor. A tiny cup of weak tea was set on the windowsill. Louis gulped the tea and crawled around, picking up crumbs and putting them in his mouth. There was a rustle outside, and a Kwajalein native appeared. He greeted Louis cheerfully, in English, by name. Louis stared at him in confusion. The man said the castaways were the talk of the island. He was an ardent track fan, and when he'd heard Louis's name, he'd come to meet the great runner. As Louis listened, bewildered, the man chattered about sports, indifferent to Louis's plight. When he glanced at his watch and said he had to go, Louis stopped him. What happened to the Marines held there? They're all dead, the man said. All POWs held on Kwajalein were executed. As the man left, the guard looked challengingly at Louis, lifted a flattened hand to his throat, and made a slashing gesture. He pointed to the names on the wall, then to Louis. The second day began. Phil and Louis lay in sweltering silence, expecting to be dragged out and beheaded. Louis developed explosive diarrhea, and cramps doubled him over. Flies, lice, and mosquitoes teemed on him. The heat was smothering. Down the hall, rats wallowed in Phil's waste bucket,